Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy. This week on the show, why is the world hating on Netflix's The Woman in the Window? And why don't zombies ever die? Mark Ryle and the week's new releases. We remember the great and now sadly deceased Charles Grodin. And writer and environmentalist Mancon McGann on his favourite movie. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. It's also on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all. Hope you're doing well. I braved the Irish Sea this week just gone. Just all this seawater swimming I've been hearing about. Me and my eldest son got in and swam off the coast of Louth. The thing is, it was great. I think it was actually too warm to consider myself, you know, I'm getting into the cold Irish Sea. It was positively balmy where we were. So we had a great time. We stayed in it for about 20 minutes. Felt like we were on holidays or something. So didn't quite get the full, you know, cold water shock thing. It was tepid water shock, and it wasn't shock at all. So that was fun. Anyway, that's what my week entailed. Now in TV, I was watching this.
I'm having a little birthday thing for Ivy on Saturday. Pizza Express, if you...
Oh, Pizza Express, that's a good idea. So much easier than going to all the trouble of organising a real proper party. And you're not really a kids' party person, are you, Julia?
Yeah, I kids' party. I kids' party real hard. Yeah, if you let me finish my sentence. I was going to say that... Pizza Express is great if you like that kind of thing, but what I've been planning for quite some time now is a massive party on Saturday at mine.
What's the theme?
Tarts and Vickers. I'm joking, Anne. That's a joke. There's no theme. It's a BYO theme. Fine, pirate robots. So I'm having a party. It's fine. I organise events for a living, so that will be absolutely fine. Can you help me, please?
Nope.
Yes, now that is a clip from the hilarious Motherland, which the series 3 is just finished or still coming to an end on BBC at the moment. But on Netflix, there are the first two series, which I got into just last week, and I've already watched the first two. And man, it is great. You heard there Anna Maxwell Martin playing a really under pressure mother, Julia, whose own mother has decided she's not going to mind her two kids anymore. So she's attempting to negotiate childminding as well as a proper job she has as an events manager. And she rubs up against these yummy mummies who you heard there. She actually befriends another mummy and a dad who are kind of not part of the cool gang. And it is absolutely hilarious, all about middle class parenting and how tough it is and rejoicing in how badly lots of parents getting it by, you know, I don't know, maybe putting a donut in the lunchbox. I've never done that, honest. This is hilarious. Two of the co-creators on it are Graham Lenehan and Sharon Horgan. So, you know, you're nearly halfway there when those guys are involved, or three quarters of the way there. I'm kind of late to the party on this. It's been out since 2019, but as I say, it's on Netflix. It keeps coming up and trending in Ireland thing that's on all our Netflixes now. So me and my wife dived into it, and we've just been howling laughing. It's that funny. And I don't think you have to be a parent to rejoice in it. It's just great comedy, you know, a bit like Catastrophe in some ways, even, you know, touches of The Office about it at times in terms of the awkwardness of what's going on. And actually, Diane Morgan is in Ricky Gervais's Afterlife, just a mild Office connection there. It is so, so funny. I haven't belly laughed like this in a long time. Just trying to get babysitters, children's parties going terribly wrong, school gate banter. The character you heard there, who's the real yummy mummy, Amanda, is played by Lucy Punch, and she is delightfully awful in this. She really is. It's great. You will really enjoy Motherland. First two series now available on Netflix. Do let me know if you might have been watching it. Also this week on TV, I watched Back to Barrytown, which you may have seen or you certainly might have heard about. The Commitments is 30 years old, and Ian Dempsey, who was a guest last week, chose it as his favourite movie, almost unaware that it was 30 years old. But RT have started a three-parter called Back to Barrytown, revisiting the van, the snapper, and it started last week with the Commitments. And this was good because, you know, we all know those movies. They're, you know, part of our emotional national makeup, I think, at this stage, you know. But the Commitments, the first one, it had Colm Meaney kind of narrating the story of it and visiting some of the sites again. But it also had a lot of the cast, like Angelina Ball, Robert Arkins, who played Jimmy Rabbit, Glenn Hansard, of course, and then it had Roddy Doyle. And as well as, what I really liked about it was, as well as it being a celebration of the Commitments, it was kind of honest about it and got slightly under the bonnet, not in a terribly positive way at times. So like you had Roddy Doyle, you know, talking about some bits of it that he wasn't too happy about. There was kind of Irish-isms in it that were unnecessary in the Finnish movie. Also how he had to fight to get his name on the script. What also came across, and not to speak ill of the dead, but that Alan Parker possibly wasn't the nicest presence. He, of course, directed it. And Glenn Hansard told quite a telling story where, you know, Alan Parker basically called him something awful and said, on every set I work on, there's always one awful person and you're that awful person. He used a different word to describe it. And that ruined kind of Glenn's memory of it a bit. And I just thought that was, you know, it was good to include that, that it wasn't all rosy in the garden, because often these things are just, you know, you're blowing smoke at a thing that we all love and it's easy to fall into that. So I like the way it was a bit more nuanced. And Robert Arkins, again, you know, he played Jimmy Rabbit. I'm not sure if he thought it was all that good a thing that he took part in it in the fullness of his life, you know. So it made for interesting viewing. So I'm curious to see what they make of The Snapper next week, which was, of course, directed by Stephen Frears. So we will see. Now, I wanted to mention the sad passing of Charles Grodin. He was 86. He died earlier in the week. I got a few people tweeting me. I was just back from somewhere and my phone started hopping and people were telling me Charles Grodin had died, because people will know I've mentioned him once or twice because I just adored him as an actor. He was kind of slightly off kilter, offbeat actor. He was also a writer as well. People know him, I suppose, the dad from Beethoven movies. He started out playing a kind of newlywed cad or bounder type in The Heartbreak Kid. But so many people who tweeted me talked about Midnight Run as, I guess, you know, his most wonderful performance opposite Robert De Niro. We talked about that a few weeks ago when we did Best Road Movies, and people love that film, or certainly people who listen to this show love Midnight Run. And that's probably my favorite Charles Grodin movie. If you haven't seen it, it's a wonderful road movie where Charles Grodin rips off the mafia. He's an accountant. Robert De Niro has to bring him in to collect a bounty, and they go on this midnight run. It's one of the funniest, heartfelt movies ever committed to screen, and here's a clip.
Familiar with the word arteriosclerosis? Cholesterol? You want to outline a complete balanced diet for you?
Well, mail it to me from C block.
Why would you eat that?
Why? Because it tastes good.
But it's not good for you.
I'm aware of that.
Well, why would you do something that you know that's not good for you?
Because I don't think about it.
Well, that's living in denial.
Living in denial?
Yeah.
I'm aware of that.
So you're aware of all your behavior, yet you continue to do things that aren't good for you. That sounds sort of foolish, don't you think so, Jack?
No. Stealing $15 million from Jimmy Serrano sounds foolish.
I don't think I'd get caught.
Now that's living in denial.
I'm aware of that.
Ah, yes, Robert De Niro. And the great, and now sadly late, Charles Grodin, who passed away earlier in the week. R.I.P. an acting legend. Now, it's been a strange year for the cinema, as we know, because they've been closed largely. But I was glad to see, I got a note about a new film festival starting next year, the Mayo International Film Festival. It'll take place in Castlebar from Friday the 25th of February to Sunday the 27th at the Lindenhall Arts Centre, a submission-based festival dedicated to supporting independent filmmakers and smaller production companies by offering a dynamic platform to showcase their work. So hats off to anyone who tries to set anything up in this current environment. So that's the Mayo International Film Festival from next year. And also, my old mucker, John Kelleher, reminded me that the Fastnet Film Festival is taking place, albeit online, next week from May the 26th to the 30th. This year, the festival is focusing on short films, so their In Short series will provide bite-sized tutorials by a wide range of industry professionals on their particular expertise. They're going to be like 2 to 12 minute short tutorials, which I like the idea of, you know, bite-sized information for people interested in short movies and movies in general. And they're going to have Ed Gainey, of course, from Element Pictures, Joan Bergen, the costume lady, Roz Hubbard and John Hubbard on casting, Mark O'Halloran on script writing, Ross Whittaker on directing documentaries. So a lot there for budding filmmakers. Simply go to fastnetfilmfestival.com to check out the full program, and that's running from the 26th to the 30th of May this year. And I'm delighted to mention that for all involved. Now, I just want to mention last week, a lot of people loved Ian Dempsey, but I got a few people suggesting I was a bit naive. I was talking to our man in Hollywood, Tim Gray, about the Golden Globes being cancelled in essence, and Tom Cruise handing back his awards and all that stuff. And, you know, Tim Gray's take on it was that it was all about money. It was about, you know, networks negotiating better deals for it. It was about agents wanting better deals, and that Hollywood is a cesspit of power and money, in essence, is what he was saying. And people said, you know, I acted surprised, and how naive was I? I got an interesting tweet from a Muddy May Suggins, and she tweeted, John Fardy, that's me, Hollywood is all about money and power is news to you, please. And then she says, P.S. I'm a fan of your work. Well, you know, that's why I'm reading it out. But you're too smart to be that naive. It's called woke capitalism. Sure, the diversity hysteria is a nice bolt-on, but you know exactly what the real motivation of the entire industry is. Plus, the narcissism is off the charts. I assume the narcissism is the Hollywood people as opposed to me, but you never know. Look, I take your point, and I like the phrase woke capitalism, because I think there's a huge amount of truth in that. And Tim Gray was saying that, and certain elements of Hollywood have probably latched on to diversity and inclusion in a way to further their position. But that said, you have to also bear in mind that Hollywood and what they produce is so important to so many people, and so formative of almost their identity and that the world they see. It's, you know, as important as politics and what happens in parliaments in some ways. It gives us a view of the world, these movies, these blockbusters, these small movies, these big movies. They inform people in ways that few other things do. So I do think it's important that Hollywood attempt to be more inclusive, because we get a worldview from Hollywood, and it's a very pervasive worldview. So it's important that Hollywood try and be inclusive, even if sometimes that inclusiveness is actually people just trying to negotiate more power or more money for themselves. I still think that notwithstanding, Hollywood becoming more inclusive is a very important thing. I'll get off my soapbox now. But all views, all opinions are welcome. Well, you know, most views, most opinions to do with movies and TV are welcome on this show. So you can email me screentime@newstalk.com, or you can tweet me, John_Fardy is my Twitter address. And then just finally in TV, this is not a sports show, but one thing occurred to me in terms of what I was going to talk to you about in television this week. And that's the fact that every week since last August, is it August? Yeah, I guess it is August. I have been watching at least one Everton football match a week. I am a lifelong Everton fan. And so I spend a certain amount of my weekly viewing watching them play. And you've had hours of sport already on News Talk, so you don't need this from me. But strictly from a TV point of view, I've watched a lot of Everton this year because they are on the verge of having an okay season. We have a new manager called Carlo Ancelotti, who was wildly successful. He brought in some new players, and the season started remarkably well. It went steadily downhill, unfortunately. And now, as I talk to you on Friday or Saturday, depending on when you're listening to this show, we are on the verge of possibly or possibly not qualifying for Europe. We may not, because we have to beat Man City. Now, why I'm telling you that is that it's all over on Sunday. And I'm kind of relieved that I'm not going to have to watch it for a while, because it's slowly been taking over my life. And it puts me in a bad mood when they lose. It puts me in a good mood when they win. And I think my household, and not just me, but my entire household, could do without that for a few months. So Everton, I love watching you. I always will. But it's nice to have a little break from each other for a while. Up next, Mark Ryle on the week's new releases.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. It's that stage of the week where I welcome Mark Ryle, our resident critic, to the show to review this week's new releases. This week we're looking at Zack Snyder's Army of the Dead, I guess a zombie heist movie, you might say, and a movie that came out last week, but there was no screeners available, and it is currently number one in Ireland on Netflix the last time I checked. The Woman in the Window. He's my man in the window, or something like that. Mark Ryle, how are you?
Generally well, John. How are you?
Generally well. Good, good. That's pretty upbeat for you, I'd have to say. So, we will start with Army of the Dead, a zombie heist movie. Dave Bautista, Zack Snyder, who people will know from the Dawn of the Dead remake, Batman versus Superman. You know, in a, I was going to say in a acquired taste, not a critical darling, it's fair to say.
He's Zack divisive, Snyder. Yeah, but he is certainly in acquired taste, and some people love him.
Yes, indeed. I'm sensing you mightn't. But anyway, so what's going on with Army of the Dead? Give our listeners a sense of what this is about.
Well, there's nothing like a good zombie movie. And you know what I'm going to say next, John? This is nothing like a good zombie movie. This is going to sound like heresy to Romero purists, but I actually quite liked Snyder's Dawn of the Dead remake back in 2004. Everything though he's done after that, like 300 and Sucker Punch, and I can't mention the DC stuff because I don't want to be shot. Anyway, this is Army of the Dead. The story is Las Vegas has been overrun by an outbreak of zombies, and months after the fact, the outbreak is contained, but the president has decided to nuke the entire site. But there is $200 million in cash stored in the vault of one of the casinos, and the casino owner offers an ex-mercenary played by Dave Bautista, $50 million of it, if he can get in, retrieve the money, and get out before the entire site is obliterated.
Yes, and Batista's character hires a kind of almost like a Dirty Dozen gang to help him, someone to crack the safe, someone to fly the helicopter, someone who might be good at shooting zombies. That's part of the story.
Shooting zombies would probably be, that's a good idea. I know this sounds very, very petty to be picking holes in the logic of a movie about zombies, but I think the internal logic here is ridiculous, even by zombie movie standards. It's full of characters that are supposed to be smart, doing really, really dumb things at the worst possible time because the plot demands it. In fact, within 30 seconds of each character's introduction, I knew exactly what was going to happen to each one of them and when it was going to happen. I think Army of the Dead is an action movie for people who have never seen an action movie before. I mean, if you've never seen Aliens or Predator, I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. But I think the script is very, very lazy, and it just doesn't build any suspense at all. It does not know when to call it quits. This just goes on. And then just as you think it's been put out of its misery, it goes on some more.
Oh dear, because you said he was a divisive character. Well, this will be a divisive review, because I'll tell you where I'm at with it, if I might, Mark, if that was okay with you.
You never cease to amaze me.
You see, Zack Snyder, you know, an acquired taste and not someone I've given a huge amount of thought to. You know, I enjoyed Dawn of the Dead, his remake of the Romero movie. The DC movies left me kind of cold. Yeah. But like, I thought Batman versus Superman was tosh. It's not even a word. That's how bad it was. Yeah. I didn't mind 300. It's a long time since I saw it. So I wasn't expecting much from this. And maybe it's limited expectations or whatever, or low expectations. But I really enjoyed this for a couple of reasons. Firstly, it wasn't like a zombie apocalypse movie. They got the zombies coming to Earth out of the way almost in the opening sequence. So what you're faced with is about 15 minutes into it, you then get into all these zombies being trapped in Las Vegas, that they're going to go on this heist movie to fight the zombies to get this money that's in this Las Vegas that has been entirely taken over. Secondly, I thought the zombies were kind of cool. They looked creepy. Some of them kind of had emotions. Stylistically, I thought it was very clever. Like, they're playing Viva Las Vegas by Elvis at the start. There's a mad Liberace character. Really nice use of the Cranberries song. I like the Dirty Dozen kind of thing. It was complete popcorn, but I did find it entertaining the whole way through.
I think the whole way through, because I think what I get what you're saying about at the start, because it starts well. The opening credits are quirky and have this kind of satirical edge, but it writes a check that the rest of the movie does not cash. I think the opening credits suggest that the tone that we're going to get is going to be something sardonic and knowing, something like Zombieland. But it's nothing of the sort, as far as I'm concerned. It turns out to be very much business as usual. And I think if you put together a focus group of 14-year-old boys and workshopped what they wanted to see in a movie, this is exactly what you would get. You know, topless zombie strippers, ex-wrestlers, and guns, lots and lots of guns. There's a fetish for firearms here that I found quite sickening, really. There's lots of shots of people stroking assault rifles lustily that I found quite objectionable.
Yeah, I didn't notice that. I did think it was incredibly gory, but I guess that's what you sign up for.
Don't mind that in a zombie movie. That's really what you want.
But did you not think the zombies were well put together? Like, they looked zombie-like?
It didn't do it for me. To be honest, I think this really demonstrates everything about Snyder as a filmmaker that I dislike. He obviously wants to be seen as an auteur. He, in addition to writing and directing, he's also acting as cinematographer. Mm. And he's got a very, very recognizable, distinct style, but it is not one that I find appealing. For starters, he uses a lot of green screen. I think he uses the principal photography stage of the shoot as just raw materials that he can manipulate as much as he likes in post-production. And that's exactly what he's done with Tig Notaro. She was replaced in post-production. She replaced another actor completely, which is the reason that she seems to be in another movie for most of the time. I don't think she's ever seen with another character on screen. But more than that, Snyder is really, really fond of shallow focus, and every shot uses this shallow depth of field with one tiny pinprick in focus, and everything else in the frame is just blurry, and it just gets tiring. Also, shooting action, which there's a lot of action in this, but he's got one go-to method for shooting action, which is to, you know, combine super fast stuff with frames of film removed to make it look even faster, so you can't really tell what the hell is going on, and then combining that with super slow-mo, both in the same shot. And like I said, it gets tiring after a while.
And you didn't, what I really liked about it as well was, well, really like is maybe stretching, but what was good was the idea of them all being cocooned in Las Vegas. Like, Las Vegas is, I don't know, you know, the antithesis of existence or something. There's such an unreality to it. I've been, I don't know if you had, but it's probably the weirdest place I've ever been, but one of the most enjoyable places. But you do really feel like this is, you know, someone said, I think it was the French philosopher Baudelaire, that it exists to prove to America that the rest of America exists because it's so unreal. You know, just throwing a bit of French philosophy there to keep you on your toes. But I thought having it as a prison Las Vegas, because all the zombies are in Las Vegas and there's these containers that don't let them out, and there's this zone on the outside of it where people are quarantined, interesting enough. Like, I thought that worked really well as a setting, but again, I'm assuming you didn't.
I didn't. No, like I said, it starts off great, and I'll go back to the opening credits. If there was more of that throughout, it would have been much, much better. But as it stands, it just gets very, very pedestrian and run-of-the-mill very quickly, I think. I mean, that is just my opinion.
No, you don't need to say that. You don't need to say that's a non sequitur. That's just my opinion. We want your opinion. Yeah, I think maybe I wasn't looking forward to it, and I found it blistering, action-packed for the 2+ hours I watched it. What are you going to say stars-wise?
I'm going to give it 2. I really do think it's quite shoddy.
Okay. I, earlier in the week on The Hard Shoulder, gave it 4. Maybe wow. I overstated that. I'm going to give it 3.5, though, because I was entertained. Now, it's been on Netflix only since Friday. That is the 21st of May. So depending on when you're listening to this show, do let us know if you might have watched Army of the Dead on Netflix. You can text us 53106. You can email us screentime@newstalk.com, or you can tweet me John_Fardy. Let's take a clip of Army of the Dead.
We are putting together a crew for a job.
Yeah, what does it pay?
Well, if it pans out, you make $2 million for one day's work.
$2 million?
But
that's my share. That's just for me. $2 million if it pans out. 100% I'm in, yeah.
You don't want to know, you know, the risks, or?
Why would I want to know the risks? $2 million? It's a lot of cash. Listen, I hate my life so deeply. If I had $2 million, my life would change drastically. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
You sure you don't want to know?
I bet it has something to do with a helicopter.
Yeah.
I'm the helicopter guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where do I sign?
Army of the Dead, now available to stream on Netflix. Okay, I think there's going to be blood on the tracks some more now, because we move to another Netflix movie called The Woman in the Window, which launched last Friday, but we weren't sent any screeners, and I did want to talk about it with my partner in crime, Mark Ryle. Mark, The Woman in the Window, based on a very successful novel from a couple of years ago. Just give our listeners again a sense of what this is about, if you would, please.
Oh my, where do I begin with this? The Woman in the Window. It's a terrible movie with a fantastic pool of talent. You know, it's got a pool of talent, including Amy Adams, Julianne Moore, Atonement's Joe Wright, and Pulitzer Prize winning screenwriter Tracy Letts, who also has a small role as the therapist in this. But I think...
And Gary Oldman.
Yeah, I knew you were going to bring up Gary Oldman. I wasn't...
But you have to mention that he's in it.
I was deliberately omitting him from the pool of talent.
Do you not like Gary Oldman?
I will come to that.
Oh dear. So are you saying generally you don't like Gary Oldman, not just in this?
I think Gary Oldman woke up around 1995 and he decided to just be Nicolas Cage.
Oh dear. Definitely blood on the tracks. Definitely blood on the tracks.
Yeah, I know. But what this goes to show is that, you know, pedigree is no guarantee of quality, and sometimes good people do bad things. So the story here is Amy Adams says, "Is someone there?" a lot. She plays Anna, who's a child psychologist, and she has suffered an unspecified trauma that has left her suffering from agoraphobia and suicidal thoughts. She befriends the weird kid that's just moved in across the street and starts to worry that the father has a violent streak. And then she goes full on Jimmy Stewart when she sees the mother murdered. But as she is heavily medicated and drunk 80% of the time, nobody believes her.
Yes. And you mentioned Jimmy Stewart. There's kind of, they're aping a Rear Window Hitchcockian vibe from time to time. In fact, I think there's even a shot of Rear Window.
There is. Joe Wright addresses the Rear Window influence head on. I think there's a couple of slowed down frames of Rear Window in the opening credits.
Okay, so, I mean, it's obvious you really didn't like this. We'll get to my considered view in a minute, but what did you find so displeasing about it?
Well, something doesn't seem right here from the very, very beginning. And as it goes on, that sense of something being not quite right extends to every aspect. The first thing you notice is that it's very play-like, very theatrical. Now, that's not always a bad thing. You can say the same thing about, I don't know, Glengarry Glen Ross or Bad Times at the El Royal, and they are great. But the play-like nature, it's not just in the staging, it's in the acting as well. And not only does everybody involved in this look like they're acting in different types of movie, but they are all working in this register that's obviously suited to theatre. And everything is big and exaggerated. And at a certain point, I fully expected Amy Adams to come to the front of the stage and belt out a musical number about agoraphobia.
But hang on a second, right? It's based on a book, not a play.
Yeah, I know that. I know that it's based on the book. I haven't read the book, but
Where do you think the theatricalness of it comes from then, if it's based on a book?
I have no idea, but it even goes as far as the musical score. Danny Elfman did the music, and it doesn't enhance or embellish what's happening on screen at all. In fact, most of the time, it doesn't even relate to what's happening on screen. It's incredibly bizarre and overbearing, and it just adds to the general offness of it. I think what's happened here, because there was extensive rewrites and there was significant reshoots as well.
And there was test audience reaction.
Exactly. I think what's happened is there's been an overbearing producer that has kind of stepped in, and it's probably turned into something that might have started out as one thing and ended up as something else entirely. But like I said, I think this just goes to show that you can do stuff in a book that doesn't work when you try and transfer it onto the screen. They're very, very different mediums. And there's many a good book that's been turned into a bad movie, of which this is one. And I think, you know, it's okay sometimes to just leave a book as a good book.
Yes, absolutely. Overbearing producers. Speaking as a radio producer as well, I can attest to how problematic they can be. Okay.
Well, I mean, I was talking about a film producer.
No, absolutely. But I'm sure we're all cut from the same stuff. But listen, here's the thing, right? That's the name of Alec Baldwin's podcast, incidentally. Here's the thing. But I was expecting this to be atrocious. Now, I know you're saying it's atrocious because, one, we weren't given a screener, and Netflix are usually...
And you weren't disappointed.
With all that kind of stuff. No. Let me finish, please. And then all the... it was meant to get a cinema release, then they decided to go to Netflix, then there was the whole test audience and all that kind of stuff. So the bar was really low for this. I was expecting this to be to the point of, I'm not actually going to be able to watch this. Like, that's how bad I sensed it was going to be. And for me, it wasn't. And I watched it with my wife, and we both looked at each other afterwards and said, that wasn't that bad. Like, a couple of things about it. I completely agree that it was so obvious that this was a book. Like, every kind of episode began with the day of the week. And when the kid arrives, when the wife arrives, it was so novel-esque. Like, you could see the rivets of where they turned it from a book into a movie. So I absolutely agree with you that. But I thought Julianne Moore was sassy and cool in it the brief time she was in it. Yeah. I just thought Amy Adams was good. I never find her bad. I've never seen her act badly. And I didn't think she was bad in this. I thought the material didn't serve her well, but I thought she was good. Now, people adored this book. And I'm sure if you read the book, you would hate the movie. It is trending number one during the week in Ireland. Now, I know that isn't always, you know, a way to encapsulate what's good. People are just turning up for what's curious. But it did hold my interest. Mm. I didn't turn it off because I wanted to see what happened. I thought the ending got far too hammy and turned into something ridiculous.
It turned into Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, that's actually a good way. It ended up in Scooby-Doo mode. But I stayed with it and I didn't find it as objectionable as I thought it was going to be. And I mentioned earlier in the week what I gave The Army Dead. I gave this a 2 on the hard shoulder because if there hadn't have been all this backstory to it, I would have said this is a pretty ordinary movie, probably not one to bother with, but it's fine. But because there was such a troubled backstory, I gave it a kind of upbeat 2 because it's not as bad as I thought. It's like when people see photographs of me and then they actually meet me in person. It's like, you don't look so bad in person. So it's kind of a bit like that, you know? So what would you say stars-wise?
I hear what you're saying. I just think it's a disaster. I'm going to give it 1.5.
We're getting into fractions.
It's worse than Army of the Dead, and that's saying something.
Wow. Blood on the tracks this week.
I can't tell you what I said after I'd finished watching it.
You did watch the whole thing, though, didn't you?
I always watch the whole thing.
No, I know, I know.
I'm contractually obliged to watch the...
Yes, you are. Those big books and all that kind of stuff.
I don't have the luxury of switching stuff off.
Yes, indeed. Okay, well, look, The Woman in the Window, it has been out for a week, so we'd love to know what you've made of it. John_Fardy is my Twitter, or you can email us screentime@newstalk.com. Mark, we were in complete disagreement, but I enjoyed myself, so thank you.
Thank you, John.
Up next, Mancon McGann on his favourite movie.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. It's that stage of the week where we talk to someone well-known about their favourite movie. I'm delighted to be joined now by Mancon McGann, who is a writer and documentary maker and a regular contributor on TV and radio. His latest book is 32 Words for Field, Lost Words of the Irish Landscape. More of that anon. He joins me now to chat about his favourite movie, which is indeed an intriguing choice, which shouldn't surprise us because he's an intriguing individual. Mancon, how are you?
Very good. Lovely to hear from you, John. Thanks so much.
So listen, I said it was an intriguing choice. And in that, because no one's ever picked it, I imagine a lot of our listeners have never even heard of it. So will you tell our listeners what you've opted for as your favourite movie?
So my favourite movie is Les Amants de Pont-Neuf. And I don't really know why this is my favourite, except it made this enormous impact on me when I first saw it when it came out in 1991. And still, like, years later, when I think back about this film, it is the one that I think most got under my skin. So, like, Les Amants de Pont-Neuf, it means the lovers of the new bridge. And the new bridge is a certain bridge in Paris, like, not too far from Notre Dame. And Les Amants, the lovers on the new bridge. And the lovers are these two sort of lost souls, these two wandering oddballs who are living rough on the streets of Paris. And one is this basically, he's a circus performer, a street performer, Alex, played by Denis Lavant. And he's like addicted to alcohol and to sedatives, and he has all this trauma in his past, and he's thin, he's sort of measly, but incredibly alive and nimble. And you can see that when he's like, he's basically using Paris as his plaything, a bit like where parkour performers, you know, these pavement gymnasts in France at the moment. He was like an early account of that. And then his love interest, the other oddball who he meets up, is a woman called Michelle. And she's played by Juliette Binoche, which almost back then in 1990s, that tells you everything about her character. Juliette Binoche always played these, you know, gorgeously beautiful, frazzled, haunted, extremely creative, marginal figures that you just couldn't help fall in love with. These sort of wounded sirens. And that's exactly who she is. So you have these two people, and you just, the minute you see them in this wasteland, beautiful, like in ancient mausoleum of a wasteland in Paris, trying to make their way, trying to find their love, one is hooked.
And presumably this was 1991, I think it was. So you were a young man at the time. What was it about it that kind of spoke to you?
Yeah, I would have been 21 and had grown up in Dublin and was sort of feeling really confined by what was around me. And this just seemed so exotic and alluring. And I remember I went to see it in the Screen Cinema in Dublin, you know, and that we always felt more sophisticated when you went then. The sort of, that was the nearest we had to an arthouse cinema. And it was like, it was just giving glimpses of other worlds. So I just loved the fact that, you know, I was from Donnybrook, this sort of middle class, you know, safe bourgeois family. And these were these extremist peoples, like, you know, one basically a drug addict, this madcap Michelle, the artist. And then this other old bum, an old sort of street vagrant named Hans. And it was just so, it was so outside my normal field of sort of habitual life. But at the same time, I was desperate to see other worlds. This was just before, well, just after I'd spent a year in Africa. And all I wanted to do was get out and see the rest of the world. The next few years, I was going to be spending a lot of time in India, a lot of time in South America, trying to meet real, creative, marginal, edgy people. And it was like, it was all captured for me in Les Amants de Pont-Neuf.
Great. Well, that certainly sounds like a stylish choice for a favourite movie, and one that maybe inspires you to do other things. Just in terms of watching movies and TV, you don't own a television and haven't for a long time, right?
No, I don't think I've ever had a television in my life. So obviously there was a TV when I was growing up. But back then, I was grew up in Dublin and Donnybrook. But, you know, we were meant to speak only Irish language. So there wasn't much even watching of TV unless my mum or my granny wasn't around to catch us. So 1991 was when I saw that film, and then I spent the next 6 years traveling the world until, like, going just never setting as little time in Ireland as I could, living up in the Himalayas, living in the Rockies, living in the Andes. And eventually in 1997, my brother came out and with a TV camera. And 1996, actually, he came out in 1996, and that was when TG Carr was setting up. We made a travel documentary that was, like, was shown in the first, I think the second day of TG Carr ever in 97. But then we spent the next decade making TV programs, and it sort of made me a bit jaundiced about TV, because I realized a lot of the rubbish, the sort of tawdriness of it. I was so annoyed. I'm so bored of myself doing pieces to camera and just focusing on some things and ignoring others, that I've never really had confidence in TV. Despite, as you said, that was 97, and ever since, that's like 24 years of making TV programs. But I edit them. I go into the post-production studio and do the voiceover, but then I don't tend to see them again.
Wow. And so, I mean, you know, half the world have been binging box sets during this bizarre pandemic time, but I guess you haven't been doing any of that. And I don't mean that as a criticism, far from it.
No, I'm addicted to podcasts. Like, I'm always in awe of when I hear of people like you who say, like, I've seen this film a few times. Like, as it happens, I've seen Les Amants de Pont-Neuf twice. I saw it in 1991. It all stayed with me. And then about 7 years ago, I was a resident in the Centre Culturel Irlandais, you know, in the Irish Centre in Paris. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, that's the film. I remember Lisa Hannigan was going to come over for dinner, and there was a few others. There was Donald Teskey, an artist. There was Judith Ring, a composer. There was all these Irish artists were there together. And I thought, let's watch Les Amants de Pont-Neuf. And it was totally different from what I imagined it to be. But anyway, I can't remember why I was telling you that now. Oh, yeah. So I don't watch movies twice. You know, I'll go to the cinema and see a movie. But what I do is, and what I would have done this year during the COVID year, is just binged on podcasts instead. I adore audio. I love radio. I love podcasts.
Yeah. Well, listen, I want to ask you about your new book, but en route to that, you know, everyone always talks to you about your house building. I know you built a house famously of straw, and then that didn't work out after a few years. There were some cracks, as far as I know. And then about 10 years ago, you built a house from a variety of materials. It has a grass roof. There is cement, but there's also straw and mud. People ask you about that a lot. And I wonder, is part of people's fascination with that outside of the actual house more to do with the fact that here's someone who successfully seemed to get out of the whole mortgage rat race?
Yeah, I reckon so. So, like, the reason that I've been able to live my life so far, and I was doing a lot of travel, doing very little work and just messing, is because, well, first, thanks to all those years living in Africa and South America and India, I realized, God, most of the world don't have a mortgage. Most of the world do build a house out of what's around them. So then that's what I did. I came back to Ireland, found cheap land, built the house. And as you say, like, I'm certainly not a good person to talk to about building good houses or long-term houses. Like, the first house lasted 6 years. The second house, it's fine. The house with the grass roof and the mud and the straw on the outside and the plaster mixed all of it. It's fine, but it's just basically a big room. It's just a big square room. It's a hovel, really. But I just love, like, I must have been a hermit in the past life. I love simple spaces. And so I think, yeah, what the reason that people are excited is, or, you know, are interested in is, first, we all would love to find a way of avoiding the rat race, avoiding mortgages, avoiding rush hour. And I found one way of doing it. I don't know would it be suitable for other people, because other people would probably look at this little hovel I live in and just think, you know, on my own for years and years, and think, like, get a life. There's more to that. But it suits me. And you know, and since then, whatever, 20 years ago again, when I first got the land and I planted my woodland. And so now, mm-hmm, I have this, like, fully mature oak woodland. And now most of the day, or a few hours every day, is just spent growing either vegetables or looking after fruit trees or looking after hens, and sometimes have pigs. So it's a different type of way of life.
But I was just going to say, on the forest, you've planted a serious amount of trees. It's into the thousands, right?
Yeah, so, like, whenever I'd be confused about the world or about myself, I would just go out and plant trees, and it made sense of things. And as well, I realized, like, for a lot of that time, And the last 20 years, I've been a travel journalist, basically flying all over the world. And I just thought it might be good to start, you know, sucking up some of that carbon that I'm expend, that I'm putting up into the upper atmosphere when I'm flying. So it was a nice balance. It was two things. At first, it gave me like psychological happiness when I knew there were trees growing. And also I thought, okay, if it consumes some of the carbon, then everybody wins. And then when I started keeping pigs a few years ago, I thought there'd be nothing better for pigs to be than in their own oak wood.
Well done. And then finally, your latest book, 32 Words for Field, Lost Words of the Irish Landscape. Now, I haven't read it, but I've read about it. And I mean, the top line, as far as I understand it, is something along the lines of that, you know, understanding Irish and particularly older aspects of Irish is almost a different way of inhabiting yourself in the world. Is that right? I mean, you make pretty profound claims for speaking Irish and what it can actually do to your understanding of your place as an Irish person, but also kind of your own psyche.
Yeah, you're right. It's basically because Irish is one of those, is sort of still connected to one of the old languages, the old Indo-European languages, a bit like you know, like Sanskrit or like Hindu. These language or Aramaic, these languages that were, you know, from a pre-developed world. I mean, all languages come from pre-developed world, but Irish remain very conservative, remains, you know, very like it was long ago. So then you have a language that is rooted to a world where people are still dependent on nature, that they're not thinking in industrial ways. They're not thinking of time as so something on a clock. And that does give you a different way of looking at the world on a practical level, because you're really rooted. All of the adjectives and the phrases, they're all about to do with the seasons, to do with nature, to do with life out there. And then the other, because Ireland has always had this strong belief in the other world, in the fairy world, in mythology and mythic stories, then again, a lot of the words and the parables and the proverbs are connected with that. So if you go into it, you suddenly think, God, I'm now speaking this language. I am now seeing the world through an almost native, natural, sort of indigenous way. And I'm being put in touch with that grander, magical view at the same point. So yeah, I mean, you know, you wouldn't just do it with Irish, any old language, you can do that. But if we do tune ourselves into that, I think it does open us to different ways of seeing the world.
Well, his favourite movie is Les Amants de Pont-Neuf, The Lovers on the Bridge. His latest book is 32 Words for Field. Mancon McGann, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, John. It's been lovely talking to you.
Yes, Mancon McGann there, talking to me about his favourite movie, Les Amants de Pont-Neuf, The Lovers on the Bridge. And a fascinating guy, Mancon. Always interesting about any topic, in essence. Can't play you a clip of the movie because it's in French. I mean, I'd be fine. You guys would struggle, but I'm joking, of course. That's it for this week. Anne-Marie Kane deserves some thanks, as she does every week, for helping me out on the show. I'll just remind you, the show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. Have a good weekend. Stay safe. Have a good week. And I will talk to you all next week.